Let me start with Romans 12, verse 2. It says, do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Paul confronted the Romans with a basic dynamic. And this dynamic was true then, and it's true now. And the dynamic is we are going to be shaped by one of two things in life. You're going to be shaped by the culture surrounding you, or you're going to be shaped by God's word. Those are the only two alternatives we have. And what we're going to look tonight is how are we being shaped by the culture? Specifically, just looking at the culture. What's going on in the culture around us? The early church described this as the problem of the word versus the world. They didn't see the culture as neutral. Now, I love being an American. I'm proud of being an American. But we cannot be naive about the American culture and the way that it's shaping us in negative ways as well. So we're going to take a real strong look at that. How should we as Christians understand our culture? I'm going to give you a series of snapshots, really simple, really quick, what's going on in our culture. The number of people who are living together in the last 50 years has changed 1,000%. 1,000%. Rate of divorces in the United States, just in this 15-year window, has doubled from 1965 to 1980. What happened? Why? The crime rate from 1960 to 1980 increased by 300%. Why? In 1950, 22% of American adults were single. Approximately 50% of American adults today are single. The rates of illegitimate births just from 1950 to 1985 increased by 500%. Why? These are incredibly radical symptoms of something. What's happening in our culture that we're seeing these kinds of changes happening around us? What's happened? Well, I think simply, to give you the cheat sheet answer, individuals' purpose, morality, and approach to relationship has changed. And the rest of the night, we're going to be explaining that. What does that mean? The first problem before us, though, is the fact that it's difficult. We have a hard time understanding what's going on. We have a problem with the forest and the trees. We've heard the old illustration, you don't understand the forest because you're surrounded by the trees. And that's exactly what happens to us. We don't understand the big picture of what's happening to us because we don't understand the big picture. We're surrounded by the individual parts of our own life and our families, our relationships, and our problems. And we don't understand the American culture as a whole. There's a Chinese proverb that explains this. It says this: if you want to understand the water, don't ask a fish. Why? Don't ask a fish. Why? Because a fish sees by means of the water. They're immersed in the water. They're swimming through the water, and they don't understand the water. That's part of their reality. And that's the way it is for us as Americans. It's very hard for us as Americans to understand our water, to understand our culture. But that's exactly the problem in front of us. We have to understand the culture that we're around in. Now, there's a fellow by the name of Robert Bella, and I'm going to refer to him a couple times tonight. He's considered one of the leading sociologists in America. And he wrote this book called Habits of the Heart with some other folks, and it is considered the leading kind of commentary on American culture in the last 30 years. He said, the Americans from whom we talked had a real difficulty piecing together a picture of the whole society and how they related to it. We call this the problem invisible complexity. It's the problem of the forest and the trees. So how do we deal with this? How do we respond? We need a synthesis. We need a big picture synthesis, a bird's eye view. At the Pentagon a number of years ago, a staff person, a fairly low-level staff person, went and did research for a long time on trying to understand what the impact would be of a military attack on the communication system of the U.S. They submitted their report to their superior. Superior looked at it, read it, got scared. Immediately gave it to his superior. He got scared. Up the ladder it goes. Within a day, it's in the White House. Report back comes back down. Get rid of the report off of everybody's computer except ours. A handful of people in the country could read this report. In an article in the Wall Street Journal called The Ultimate Secret, a Pentagon report its author can't see. This is what the governmental representative said. Sometimes when you put things together, you get a whole that's more sensitive than any of its parts. In other words, when you get that big picture, all of a sudden you see something you haven't seen before. You haven't seen it because you're just dealing with your trees. We have to see the forest. Now, I've already apologized for the first people who are in here. I'm going to apologize again. You're going to feel like this is an overwhelming amount of content. Just realize I understand that, and we can have times of discussion to talk about it. But I need to paint this big picture to you tonight to you to understand kind of the issues that we're challenged by in the American culture today. In the 1950s and 60s, these surveys were done, and they basically showed that Americans' fundamental commitments were to their loved ones economic, social, and emotional well-being. In other words, the fundamental commitments Americans had were the people that were in their family. Their family's economic, social, and emotional well-being. Guess what happened 20 years later? 20 years later, the individual Americans are committed to their own personal economic, social, and emotional well-being. It had been flipped on its head. What had happened? What happened with this huge change was what I would call the pursuit of happiness or the pursuit of fulfillment. Dan Yankelevich wrote about this a number of years ago in a book called New Rules. He says, cross-section studies of Americans show that unmistakably the search for self-fulfillment is an authentic grassroots phenomenon involving, in one way or another, perhaps as many as 80% of Americans. And this was years ago. I think it's higher than this now. Now, I kind of underlined the problem, just really briefly. I haven't talked about it, I haven't described it, I haven't developed it. I've just mentioned it. But to understand this problem, we can't talk anymore about the problem. We actually have to go back in history to understand what's the history that leads up to the problem. What's the context of our culture historically that helps us understand our situation today? And to do that, we're going to talk about a Frenchman. A fellow by the name of Alex de Tocqueville's Democracy in America was written about 170, 180 years ago. And this individual, to this day, is considered the leading commentator on American character and culture. To understand where we are today, it's very useful to get a historical window on where we are when we look at the past, understanding where we are today because of where we were in the past. Again, just one line to underline this. Bella, the fellow I mentioned, wrote the best book on American character and culture in the last 30 years. In his introduction to his book, he says, in the 1830s, the French social philosopher Alex de Tocqueville offered the most comprehensive and penetrating analysis of the relationship between character and society in America that has ever been written. And he went on to say that our book's only a commentary on what he wrote. So even to this day, de Tocqueville's being used as this reference point to understand America. So it's very useful to understand what he actually said. Now I'm going to start with something he said that's a little bit off topic, but I want to show you how powerful his insights are. He said this about American... some of these slides aren't the same slides. That's okay, I'll deal with it. He said something about Russia and America that's fascinating. Again, you have to understand that Russia and America were second-rate powers. They were not, you know, they were not the superpowers of today or 50 years ago. They were second-rate powers. They were not significant forces, nations in their time back in 1830. But he writes this about them. He says, to attain their aims, the former, America, relies on personal interests of its people and gives free scope to the unguided strength and common sense of individuals. The latter, Russia, in a sense, concentrates the whole power of man in one society, in one man, all of society in one man. One has freedom at the principal means of action. The other has servitude. Okay? Now, what's his point with all this? He brings it together and he says, their point of departure is different. Their paths are diverse, yet nevertheless, each seems called by some secret design of providence one day to hold in its hand the destiny of the entire world. And how in the world can he say this? You can say that 100 years before the Cold War, he's predicting the Cold War. He's saying there's these two very different people, very different into their structure and their understanding and their morality, and one day they're going to be influencing the entire world. It's a very fascinating comment. How did he get there? He got there by his understanding of national character, that every nation has a particular national character, social, ethical, intellectual way of understanding life. And that shapes the people in that culture. I'm going to then develop this idea when his look with the Puritans and the Americans of the 19th century. He made the comment, I think I can see the whole destiny of America contained in the first Puritan who landed on these shores. Well, how did he describe Puritans? He takes a long time to do in the book. He says they're well-to-do, they're accomplished, educated, moral, religious, organized people with a sense of enterprise, they had a hope for the future. This was in the 17th century. But in his own day, he says this had evolved to the point where Americans were self-reliant, they were self-oriented, self-thinking, they were proudful, creative, ambitious, pragmatic, mobile, they desired their own physical well-being, and they were motivated by self-interest. Does this sound familiar to you? It should. That's still a pretty good accurate analysis of American character, of a description of most Americans. Self-reliant, self-oriented, self-thinking, proudful, creative, ambitious, pragmatic, mobile. That's who we are. That's who we are. You should have a question that's starting to bounce around in your head about now. The issue of how can we see all this radical change that I've talked about, and yet we can still say that Americans are remarkably consistent from the 1830s to 2012? What's happening that we see this consistency? What's happened? What's happened that we have this radical change in the last 50 years, but at the same time, we see this amazing consistency over the last 150 years? How can we put these two snapshots together? What I'd like to suggest to you is that if we understand what de Tocqueville said, it gives us a key to open the door, to understand this problem in front of us. He summarized his understanding of American selfishness or individualism in these words. He goes, "It may be supposed from what's been said that the love of physical gratifications must constantly urge Americans to irregularities in morals, to disturb the peace of families, to threaten the security of society at large. But it is not so. It is not so. It is not so." You know, if you could picture de Tocqueville's understanding of American character, you could picture it as a wild stallion. It's powerful. He said, "I've never experienced anything like all the places." He's this nobleman traveling all over Europe. He said, "I've never seen anything like what it means to be American." So all the Americans are motivated. They're ambitious. It's not like Europe at all. He says this powerful things. But he said that there's something else beyond just the wild stallion happening. He said there were three reins that were holding the wild stallion in check. Now, his description of it is Christianity, Christian morality, and marriage. He says this about Christianity. He said the chief, he basically made a distinction between selfishness and individualism. He said selfishness is an exaggerated love of the self, connects everything to oneself, prefers oneself before all else. Individualism, and a mature and calm feeling, forms a circle of family and friends together, disengaged from society at large. In other words, he said, we're doing this in the 19th century America. We're not doing that. He goes, it's not selfishness. He specifically says it's not selfishness. American character is not selfishness. It's individualism. I pushed the button again, sorry. It's not selfishness. It's individualism. It's being reined in by these three commitments to Christianity, to Christian morality, and to marriage. Now, quickly, we're going to really briefly go through those three. He says this about Christianity in America. He says, in the United States, Christianity itself is an established, irresistible fact which no one undertakes either to attack or defend. It's the way it was in 1830. It wasn't the way it was, to be honest, in 1776. But it was this way in 1830. There was a series of revivals, and it was widespread. It was fascinating, the things he said about it. He said, in fact, that among some Anglo-Americans, some are there who profess Christian dogmas because they believe them, and others do so because they're afraid to look as if they did not believe. Okay. The point behind this is, from a Christian point of view, America in the 1830s was a much more Christian country than America in 2012. Now, just one last comment on this. The thing you have to understand is that from his point of view, when he was going around, he wasn't advocating this. He was just observing this. He was saying, I've never seen this. Christianity is widespread to the point at which people don't want to not associate with it. They can't not associate with it. They can't not be some kind of flavor of Christians. Now, the next connection to it is the issue of morality. He says this, the Americans, having admitted the principal doctrines of the Christian religion without inquiry, are obliged to accept in like manner a great number of moral truths originating in it and connecting with it. What's he saying with this? He's saying that basically the commitment people have to Christianity brings with it these moral convictions, these ethical principles, this lifestyle, this way of thinking about how to live life, how to treat your wife, how to treat your kids, how to do honest business. And these ethical principles were attached to the moral, to the doctrinal statement, the doctrinal understanding, commitment of the Americans. As Christian morality was a powerful curbing influence for Americans' individualism, and he writes of this, although the travelers who visited America differ on many points, they all agree in remarking that morals are far more strict there than anywhere else. Now, the last one is the issue of marriage. He says this, certainly all countries in the world, America is the one in which marriage ties the most respected, where the highest, truest conception of marital happiness, what he means by that concept of happiness, has been conceived. In other words, he's saying that this is an understanding approach to marriage, and he makes a lot of comments about the American women. He says the secret to America are the American women. They're the ones who hold the moral reins of their families. They're the ones who are the ones shaping their families in really profound ways. It's a fascinating comment, but it's marriage as a whole is the third ring that's holding in American individualism. So when you see this American individualism that's a part of the 19th century, it's not radical individualism where people are, you know, doing whatever they want. It's this sense that people are separated from society as a whole, but they're committed in relationship to their family and friends. Now, the problem we have is what happened from that point to today. What's going on from that point to today? And I think what you see, and I'm going to just quickly kind of fly through this, you see a change not in the national character. You don't see a change in the fundamental American national character. You see a change in the reins, the things that was holding the American character in check. Now, I don't have time to do this justice. I wrote a master's thesis on this, and the next part I'm going to cover in about 3 minutes. I covered it in 300 pages. So this is going to seem fast. It's because it's fast, and you're not going to understand it all. I'm probably doing a bad job explaining it. But I'm just going to try to explain two of those changes that happen in this 150-year period. The first of those is a shift from truth, Christian worldview, to skepticism. There's a wonderful book that was published about 25 years ago called The Closing of the American Mind. University of Chicago professor Alan Bloom wrote this in the very opening lines of the book. There's one thing that a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering university believes or says he believes that truth is relative. Where did this persuasive relativism come from? And what are the consequences? We're living in a 300-year-old shadow that's the shadow of the Enlightenment. And in the Enlightenment, originally, it wasn't an anti-Christian or anti-theistic movement. In fact, the vast majority of the original members of the British Royal Society for Science were Christians, were Orthodox Christians. Newton himself wrote more on the Bible than he did on science. And you have this incredible, you know, heritage that comes from a Christian worldview that science was born out of. Science, it comes from Christianity. Christianity is the mother of science. Most people don't understand the history behind it, but that's the truth. What you see in the Enlightenment is you see a fairly quick movement from theism toward deism, toward agnosticism, toward atheism. And you can, you know, read different people along that path. I'm just going to give you a quote of one. Diderot was a leader of the French, one of the leaders of the French Enlightenment. He said this in an agnostic prayer in one of his books. He said, "Oh God, I don't know if you exist. I ask nothing in this world. But the course of events is determined by its own necessity." What's he saying? According to this Enlightenment perspective, God is probably not there, but if he is there, he's irrelevant. Kant, who was described as the philosopher who summed up the achievement of the Enlightenment, argued that the very category of knowledge was only possible with sensory objects. So you can't know anything about God from that perspective. If you accept that as your starting point, everything that flows from that, Christianity, faith, all goes over here and knowledge is here. That's not how it's been understood for the previous 1700 years. But after Kant, it was. So all of a sudden, there's a gulf between Christianity and knowledge. And knowledge was supposed to be contained in the universities. Not just universities, but also in any of those who basically made an opposition to the gospel eventually. Now, what was the result of this skepticism? To someone on the street, these ideas appear far-fetched, unrealistic, speculative, but they have profound practical consequences. And this is my other example, is Christianity. What's the impact on Christianity? As the influence of the Enlightenment spread, other fields of thought began to operate from these new philosophical assumptions. One of the most significant of them is biblical studies, the way you approach the Bible. One leading biblical scholar explained it this way. Biblical criticism has been a principal tool in the critique of classical, meaning historic, biblical theology by the forces of the Enlightenment. By subjecting the Bible to humanistic presuppositions and treating it as a merely human text under the control of our superior techniques, we've seen the message relativized and debunked time and time again. Skeptical biblical criticism, shaped by the Enlightenment's presuppositions, treats the Bible as one more human book that presupposes that God could not give revelation. What's our conclusion from that? Conclusion, many Christians began to feel like one foot was on the Bible, as in the church, and the other foot was on their education, and they were being spread apart. And eventually, they have to leap toward one of those two boats. And that's exactly what happened. There's individuals had different responses. But one of the major responses was what could be called liberal Christianity. T.S. Eliot described or defined liberal Christianity this way. He said, in religion, liberalism can be characterized as a progressive discarding of elements of historic Christianity, which appear superfluous or obsolete. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing this massive shift from Enlightenment but basically is approaching education in such a way that that redefines Christianity as a faith commitment to the extent to which there's no assertion that it's actually true. Sounds a little bit what you read in the New Testament. Who said what is truth? Yeah, Pilate. How's Paul describe the gospel? It's the word of truth. It's the word of truth. I am the truth, the way and the life. It's a very different approach that you see in Scripture to what you've seen in the last 200 or 300 years and the categories approaching Christianity. Well, but in essence, what you see here is a molding, a shaping of Christianity that becomes a profound, you know, modified, domesticated faith. The Bible's human text, religious beliefs or opinion, not knowledge, convictions as current cultural norms, not historic truth. Christian worlds are emptied of their content. I mean, I just give you a picture of this. I did my PhD at Northwestern University. While I was there, I didn't meet a single PhD student or a single professor I worked with who was a Bible-believing Christian. And when I say the Enlightenment coming from Europe, you know, a place like Northwestern, a leading elite university, that's a European outpost. You know, that's a European outpost providing that same education that's been going on for 200 years of a secular approach to thinking about life. All the categories, all the intellectual disciplines, all the assumptions, all the methods, it's coming from that approach. So what do you see happening? That we, you know, again, we could take a really quick tour here. I'm going to just really briefly mention what's happened in the last 50 years with this issue. In the 1950s, you know, you didn't have really strong convictions. The majority of the pulpits in America were preached from mainline denomination, liberal churches, churches that had lost these strong convictions that the Bible is true. They had still kept the categories, but they'd emptied them of their content and put new content into them. I'll give you one example of this. One of my professors at Northwestern wrote a Christology. I happen to know, and we get together to smoke our pipes together at the time. I was a pipe smoker. I don't tell my kids that, so I can make sure they don't watch the video. But we smoked our pipes together. He didn't believe anything. He didn't believe the first thing, but he writes a Christology. I said, Jim, you got to explain this one to me. How can you write a Christology when you don't believe the first thing about Christianity? You don't believe in the Trinity. You don't believe Jesus was raised from the dead. How can you? And he goes, I can use the categories any way I want. They're my categories as much as yours. He's a liberal atheist who's writing theology. See, that's what's happening in the elite centers. Another professor there actually was a leading feminist scholar, and actually she protected me once in a doctoral colloquium against someone's attack, so she was honest. But she also said in a personal conversation when someone asked her, a friend of mine asked her, why are you even here? Why do you teach Christianity? And she said, "It's the churches are where the copy machines are. It's a place of power, and I can push my agenda into the culture because this is a place of power to do it." Okay, that's what I mean by liberal Christianity. Slow process. Now, not everyone is that bad who's a liberal Christian, but I'm telling you, I taught there in liberal seminaries, and people would get mad at me for quoting the Bible. You know, that's what happens. Okay, so what happens when you see this sped up into the 1950s? What you see is you don't have rooted convictions in the truthfulness of the gospel, the truthfulness of the Bible. We have a very generic religion. You know, people are supposed to believe in God. Eisenhower was claimed to say, they couldn't find out where he said it, but he said, everybody should have a faith, and I don't care what kind of faith it is. Just have a faith. In other words, it doesn't really matter, as long as you have a faith. A loss of truth, a loss of personal convictions, communication to God, understanding of obedience, the result of that is there was still a lot of the Christian ethics going on. In terms of the way you treated your family, what you did with your life, hard working, you know, and men, 96% of men said that the number one thing that they're responsible to do is to work hard for their family. There was some positive things. But what happened in response to this is that it was hypocritical. They weren't operating consistently with convictions. You have some of the most famous books of the period called The Gray Man. It's a book called The Gray Man. Also, The Organizational Man. These books describing this cultural conformity people were under during this time period. What's a reaction to that? In the 60s, you see a morality of rejection, of nonconformity, of raising ideals, the very ideals of the 50s, but raising them back to them of justice, equality, freedom, of authenticity. Ultimately, it failed and went away, but there was loss of any guiding ethic. But at the end of the day, what you have in the early 70s is you don't have a consensus of the culture shaping the way people think, and you don't have the counterculture. What you have is all those moral systems fall away. And the reigns of Christianity, morality, and marriage were no longer reigns for American individualism. And all of a sudden, you see these radical shifts in the American culture from about 65 to 75 AD. De Tocqueville said something very fascinating. He said he was scared of the individualism. He said if individuals don't learn and recognize they need to keep themselves in check, this is going to go towards selfishness. He predicted that as well. He said this, if the members of a community as they become more equal, become more ignorant and coarse, it's difficult to see what pitch of stupid excesses their selfishness may lead them. He saw the potential of this being. In other words, what he concerned is the American way of life basically, potentially, was not sustainable without those reins, without the commitment to Christianity, commitment to morality, commitment to marriage. And he basically said he was concerned that Americans could be too concerned about their private lives. They would be too selfish. And he gives the example of Rome, ancient Rome, being invaded by barbarians as only one model by which a civilization could be destroyed. He predicted, he was scared, I guess a better way of saying it, he was scared that civilization in America could be decayed from within, not destroyed from without, not conquered from without.